You're listening to the Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, the Pentagon says thousands more troops are headed to the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll discuss why and get the latest on negotiations over border wall funding in Congress. First, Democratic State Senator Fred Risser introduced legislation last week that would ban wildlife hunting competitions in the state. Risser is currently seeking co-sponsors for the bill, which would not include fishing competitions. Hunting contests, many of which are run by taverns or outdoors clubs, award prizes to those who collect the most kills or the biggest animals. Some of the most common targets are rabbits, squirrels, crows, and coyotes. Now, supporters claim the contests aren't the blood sport they're made out to be and help control predators, while opponents say it's a brand of hunting that's unsportsmanlike and unethical. Mikhail Polly is the director of Stop the Madness, a group working to end hunting contests in Wisconsin. Makai, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Adrian Trevis is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison and co-founder of the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Makai, I'm going to start with you. Can you give us a brief explanation of why you and your organization are opposed to these hunting contests?
Briefly, we feel that it doesn't support our proud Wisconsin hunting heritage. These contests target animals that have few protections under our current current laws, and they are not used for, they don't use the animals. Sometimes they will take the part of the animal, and but many times they are just left behind.
How many of these hunting contests happen around the state each year?
From what we can tell, they aren't easily found, so they're kind of just word of mouth or a poster here and there. We've identified about 26 of them per year.
And is there a particular part of the state where these happen more often than not versus other parts?
They're kind of spread out throughout the state, mostly in rural areas. But there is one in Dane County and another one in Sauk County. So they are down in the southern part of the state as well.
Now, Adrian, coyotes are one of the more hot-button animals when it comes to these types of contests. What do we know about the effect hunting competitions have on coyote populations?
We don't know a lot, and partly because these contests aren't regulated, and regulation would allow us to understand better where people are taking coyotes, how many of them, is it a male, a female, or a breeder? And if I could, I'd like to address the quote you gave about controlling coyote populations or controlling predators.
Sure.
The latest scientific evidence indicates that non-selective killing of predators does nothing to control their populations or to control what some people are concerned about, attacks on domestic animals. Non-selective killing is really an ineffective way of handling problems with a few individual coyotes that are going to attack domestic animals.
Yeah, Adrian, we're talking about coyotes, and do we know how some of these folks who set up these contests, how they're able to get around regulations?
Well, it appears to me that the DNR, the State Department of Natural Resources, has not enforced regulations to stop these contests. They, as your other guest indicated, it doesn't go with the tradition of sportsmanship and fair chase practices that usually limit a hunter's take to one animal. And it doesn't fit the North American model of wildlife conservation, where killing has to have a purpose, not just for recreation or prizes. Most everybody who has thought about these contests doesn't agree that that's hunting. So the legislature has the authority to regulate these, and ever since the early 1900s, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has affirmed that the state agency, that's the DNR, has a duty to regulate wildlife as a public trust asset, which means these contests are really flying in the face of decades of law and tradition in our state.
Makai Opali is the director of Stop the Madness, a group working to end hunting contests in Wisconsin. Adrian Trevis is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison and a co-founder of the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. They join us here on Central Time. We're talking about legislation that was introduced by State Senator Fred Risser that would ban wildlife hunting competitions in the state of Wisconsin. Makai, in the debate over these contests, we hear the term ethical hunting get used a lot. Mm-hmm. What do you see, and I know Adrian kind of alluded to it, but what do you see about these contests as being unethical?
Their chase really isn't a part of hunting in this case. Many times they use calling devices and hounds, and then they kind of sit and wait, and when the coyotes come, they shoot them with high-powered rifles. The other thing is that they don't have a lot of respect for the animals and their role in the ecosystem. Many of them don't even know what that is. They just feel that there's a lot of them, and it's fun to kill them, and that's kind of their whole purpose.
Now, have you heard from any hunters who've said that these contests in particular not something that they feel comfortable with?
Yes, many hunters have, and they see hunting as something that they're going out with their son or daughter, and they're getting their deer and they're bringing it home and only taking what they're going to use, and they're using it for their immediate family. Not the same thing.
Adrian, one of the concerns about coyotes in particular is attack on livestocks or pets, and some of these hunting contests take place on land where the owner is trying to limit those attacks. Is there a way to handle that beyond hunting?
Yeah, there are a variety of non-lethal methods that have been proven with the gold standard in experimental tests, proven to be effective in protecting domestic animals from predators, just like coyotes. A lot of those experiments were done on coyotes. So my team and my colleagues have reviewed that literature, and we have the most up-to-date results for the public. It's on my website. 21 authors from 10 nations concluded that the evidence is really, really scant for lethal methods, but the evidence is much stronger for non-lethal methods. And the problem with lethal methods is it can actually backfire, and more domestic animals can be lost after you kill a few predators, because there's this problem with non-selective killing that you may be actually killing the animals that are not culprits, not implicated in the problem, and the survivors you leave may actually redouble their efforts on domestic animals. These contests have zero evidence in support of them helping against conflicts with landowners.
Makai, what are you going to be watching for next on this bill and the issue of hunting contests more generally?
For this bill, we are really looking forward to a companion bill coming up in the Senate. We see this as a mainstream and bipartisan issue, and we're thrilled with the amount of attention it's getting. I feel that the awareness is been skyrocketing, and many people are being educated about the role that predators do play in our ecosystem, and that maybe we need to take a look at them and discuss, like Adrian said, better ways to coexist with them.
There's certainly more to come with this issue. Makai, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Adrian, thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Makai Opali is the director of Stop the Madness, a group working to end hunting contests in Wisconsin. And Adrian Trevis is the co-founder of the Carnivore Coexistence Lab at UW-Madison. They were with us to talk about hunting contests in the state after Senator Fred Risser introduced a bill to end them. We had planned to talk tomorrow on the show with a supporter of keeping those contests legal, but due to a scheduling conflict, we're now planning to have that conversation early next week. Coming up, we'll talk talk about how the partial government shutdown affected immigration enforcement and get an update on what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, our next guest says we don't give enough attention to the world of older adults and dating. The desire for companionship and intimacy doesn't go away after we turn 60. We learn more about entering the dating world as an older adult coming up next right here on Central Time. First, the Pentagon says it's sending more than 3,700 troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, bringing the total number of active duty deployed there to 6,000. The news comes as negotiations over border security funding continue in Congress, and as President Trump continues to signal an openness to declaring a national emergency for border wall funding. Alan Gomez is a reporter covering immigration for USA Today. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Drew.
Alan, what do we know so far about why the Pentagon is sending these troops to the border?
That's a very good question. I mean, obviously, the president has been very preoccupied with these caravans that are coming up from Central America to that southern border. There's reports of new groups coming up. There's about 2,400 that left Mexico City just last week, and so they're making their way north towards the border. And so, you know, on the one hand, we understand the president says this is a national security issue. It's also very well-timed to his State of the Union address tomorrow, where he's going to make his big pitch for receiving wall money. And he's talking about declaring a national emergency to get that wall built without Congress. And so all of that ties into the idea that they're trying to really create this sense that there is a national emergency and those troops would be going down to address that.
Do you know exactly how they're going to address this and what the troops will be doing?
Well, what they did the last time, and what they have been doing for several months, is, you know, we've seen a lot of the images. They're lining portions of the border with concertina wire. They're assisting Border Patrol agents with transportation, moving either people that are caught or the Border Patrol agents themselves. They're assisting with some surveillance, watching drone footage, watching camera feeds to see where groups are trying to cross the border. And we expect the same from this additional deployment of troops. They cannot act in a law enforcement capacity, given U.S. law. So what they're doing is really just assisting Border Patrol to carry out their primary mission.
Now, you spoke about the caravans and large groups of migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. It's kind of faded in and out of the headlines. Sometimes you'll hear about it for a few weeks, and then it kind of disappears, and then you hear about it again. What's the latest situation at the border?
Sure, and yeah, I mean, we mostly heard about it in those weeks leading up to the election, and then it kind of disappeared for a little while, didn't it? So where things stand right now, that original caravan, the one that we heard so much about last October and November, for the most part, it's pretty much dissipated. The vast majority of them did exactly what they were what they said they were trying to do, and approach the U.S. and request asylum, either at our ports of entry or around them. And the U.S. government has put in the administration has put in what they refer to as a Remain in Mexico plan, where now asylum seekers, once they put in their application at a port of entry at that southern border, now must return to Mexico and wait for that case to be resolved. They just started that up last week, so they're starting that process in south of San Diego. And in the meantime, over on the Mexican side, they've closed the last shelter for these migrants that they had open, because a lot of the people have either accepted visas in Mexico, returned home, or just found a different part of the border and snuck across that way. So, you know, now we're going to have another couple of waves of caravans, and this is really something that shows that that wasn't just a one-time thing. These have been going on for years. It's a way for migrants from Central America to reach the southern border with some level of safety because they can travel in a big group and protect themselves that way. So it's something that we haven't figured out how to stop completely. It's just going to continue going, and we'll see now how the Trump administration continues responding to it.
You spoke of asylum seekers waiting in Mexico now while their cases are being processed, and that's a relatively new development. Do we have any idea how that's going so far?
Very slowly. They announced it back in December, and they really took their time in implementing it, because there are many questions about the legality of this, and they wanted the process to be smooth. So they've only started so far at the San Ysidro port of entry. That's between San Diego and Tijuana. It's the biggest port along the border, the most traffic. It's where most of these migrants are going to try to request asylum. On the last Tuesday was the first day. They returned one person. By the end of the week, they'd returned about a dozen people. Because again, they're being very deliberate and they're going very slow. Mexico has kind of they're sort of going along with it and saying, yeah, they can come back and they can wait here while their asylum case in the U.S. proceeds. But there's clearly been a lot of friction there. But the Department of Homeland Security says that they're going to continue rolling out this program along the rest of the border in the weeks and months to come. So that's something that's in place right now, and there's a very strong likelihood that now that some people have been affected by it and returned to Mexico, the next phase could be lawsuits being filed against the administration to try to stop that policy. So that's the next big step we're waiting to see for now.
Alan Gomez is a reporter covering immigration for USA Today, and we're talking about the news from the Pentagon. It says they're sending more than 3,700 troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. It brings the total number of active duty deployed there to 6,000 as President Trump ramps up to give his State of the Union address tomorrow. Alan, you wrote a little bit about how the partial government shutdown affected Border Patrol. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
Yeah, I mean, it's like so many of our national security employees when it comes to the federal government, you know, they had to keep working. They, Border Patrol, customs officers at airports, they are definitely on the list that has to keep working. So they kept working throughout. Obviously, we heard a lot of the same stories from Border Patrol agents as we heard from Coast Guard members and all these other folks who really struggled to continue working through that shutdown, missing those two paychecks, and now very, very worried about another shutdown looming. I mean, we're just, 11 days away from the next deadline when we may face another shutdown if the White House and Congress can't come to an agreement on some sort of funding deal. And just from what we've been hearing so far, the signs aren't very good that they're anywhere close to where President Trump says they need to be. So, yeah, we could be in for another one unless he just accepts whatever Congress throws at them and declares his national emergency and tries to build his wall that way. So there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of folks who just spent a month without any pay and are staring down the barrel of another possible one coming up very, very soon. And that's, you know, it's a little more stressful if you're a Border Patrol agent already working a very stressful job. So it's been very tough for all of them.
A group of lawmakers have been meeting to negotiate on funding for border security and the border wall. What do we know about where those talks stand right now?
Well, it's there hasn't really been much progress. I mean, it's kind of strange. They're sort of operating in this vacuum where, you know, I think the House and the Senate could come to some sort of agreement. The general outline of what they're proposing for border security is very similar. They both want to spend a lot of money improving our ports of entry along the southern border to add more scanner technology, radar technology, so we can detect human smuggling, drug trafficking, that sort of thing. They both want to augment that southern border in different ways. But the difference is, obviously, Republicans, a lot of them want that $5.7 billion that President Trump wants. Democrats don't want that. And we also see a different approach where Republicans are pushing for more Border Patrol agents to patrol those sort of unwalled regions of the southern border, while Democrats are more pushing to add customs officers at the ports of entry, because that's where they say the majority of drugs are coming through and that we need to augment those areas. So that gives you a little idea of the different approach that they're taking, where Republicans are more focused on sort of the illegal immigration aspect of it, and Democrats really want to shore up those ports of entry to cut down on the drugs and the human trafficking that we've been hearing about so much lately.
President Trump was interviewed on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, and he was asked about shutting down the government again versus declaring a national emergency. Let's take a listen to the president.
Would you shut down the government again?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens on February 15th.
And you're not taking it off
the
table.
Well, I don't take anything off the table. I don't like to take things off the table. It's that alternative. It's national emergency. It's other things. And, you know, there have been plenty national emergencies called. And this really is an invasion of our country by human traffickers.
What's the latest on where the administration is, where they're at on declaring a national emergency?
Yeah, I mean, there has been, you know, zero evolution from them. They've stayed very firm in their insistence that this is a national emergency. Obviously, Democrats and a lot of folks who watch the border would dispute that. Just to give some quick context, last year about just under 400,000 people were caught trying to illegally cross that southern border. Back in the 2000s, it was regularly over 1 million. People a year, and 1 year 1.6 million people were caught along that southern border. So a lot of folks are kind of disputing that and saying, no, we're actually at historic lows, and so it's really difficult to now claim a national emergency. His justification has changed quite a bit. At first he was talking about the crime that they bring in. Now the last week or so, he's really been focused on this idea of human trafficking, repeating the story over and over about women who are duct tape and driven across the border. We have yet to find an example of that happening. We've asked the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection for examples. They haven't pointed us to anything. They just keep referring us back to the White House. We expect to hear a lot more of that on Tuesday night during his State of the Union address. So, yeah, they are very insistent that this is something that they're taking very seriously, and that it is a national emergency, and that is the grounds that he's going to use to get his wall if he doesn't get that $5.7 billion that he's asking for.
With about 30 seconds left, this obviously is not a route that even some Republican members of Congress are fans of, correct?
Absolutely, because one thing you can be sure of, if he declares that national emergency and if he orders the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to follow through and start building this wall, you can bet that the lawsuits will start flying immediately, because it's, you know, as we've said so many times in this administration, this is just something that we haven't seen before, and they're trying to do something that hasn't been done before. So, well, that's a lot of Republicans are seeing that as a big waste of time. So we'll see where things shake out in about 11 days.
Alan, thanks so much for joining us.
Darrell, thank you so much.
That was Alan Gomez, immigration reporter with USA Today. Coming up, it might seem like online dating has revolutionized the world of online dating for young singles, but it also offers older... You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up tomorrow after 6:30 on The Morning Show, it can be a daunting task for parents and teens to manage the challenges of puberty. For families with a child with autism or an intellectual disability, that period of time may come with unique obstacles. Kate Archer Kent and her guests discuss strategies that parents and teachers can use to help their child or student with a disability cope with the transition to adulthood. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30, right here on the Ideas Network. Now, lots of people find themselves single later on in life, whether it's due to divorce, the loss of a spouse, or maybe just never finding the right person. As we get older, it can feel more intimidating to try out dating for lots of different reasons. Maybe you feel like you're too old, don't have enough to offer someone, or just feel embarrassed about it. This clip from The Golden Girls featuring Blanche and her date Jerry gives a gist of what it can be like to get back into the game after so long.
I guess I'm just frozen back in the old days of courtship. Remember when we went to the movies last week?
Hey, when you didn't say a word to me, didn't even try to kiss me goodnight.
The way I remember it, you looked so beautiful, I felt awkward and tongue-tied like a teenager. I was afraid to kiss you.
Afraid of a little old kiss?
Hey, to me, a first kiss is still the sexiest thing in the world.
Get out of here.
Older adults today have more options to find a partner. There are many online dating options that serve the older adult singles. But how and why can someone find the courage to put themselves out there once again so late in life? Our next guest has been writing about and studying relationships and sexuality in older adults for decades and is here to offer us some expertise. Pepper Schwartz is a sociologist and sexologist teaching at the University of Washington in Seattle. She is the author of numerous books, magazines, website columns, and serves as the love and relationship expert and ambassador for AARP. She's also the relationship expert on the show Married at First Sight. Pepper, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Pepper, it's so nice to have you here for a few minutes. Thank you so much for joining us. First of all, it doesn't seem like this is something that's talked about a lot. There's not a whole lot of articles written about it. And if grandma or grandpa suddenly has a new partner, it makes some of us uncomfortable. Do you think our society tends to think of dating as something for younger people?
Yes, I think people are a little bit nervous about aging in general. There seems to be some stigma about getting older, and there seems to be some stigma about older people falling in love, being affectionate, having sex, or for that matter, even dating. So yes, I don't know why all of these prejudices exist, but I'm here to try and knock them apart.
You know, we're kind of in a unique spot in today's world. Medical practices are improving, medicine is improving, and we're living a lot longer. What does that mean for the dating pool in the world of older adults?
Well, I think the combination of living longer, living healthier longer, and, I'm sorry to say, a reasonably high divorce rate, and a higher standard of what marriage should be, all combine to have people back out in the dating pool, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. I've seen people dating at 90. So it changes the whole world if you, for example, get divorced at 60 and you think, or you're at 60, let's say you're in a marriage that doesn't work, and you go, I could be here for 30 more years as opposed to 5 more years. I think I'm going to change my life, and I'd like to have a partner again.
Now, for many older adults, the dating world can feel so much different than how it was when they were last in it. For instance, we all have cell phones and the internet. In your experience, what are some of the things that prevent older adults from trying out dating, online or not, even if they're curious?
Well, I think they're intimidated by who they are now as opposed to who they were then. We look older, our bodies aren't the same, they're certainly not as athletic, or not that we ever thought they were perfect, but they were a whole lot more perfect then. And I think it's also, besides the intimidation of being acceptable and attractive enough and all that, and for men, I think some performance issues, I just think that there's a lot of fear. Who is this person? If I go online, will they take advantage of me? Am I available to a scam? I've heard all these stories. You know, is it really outrageous for me to think about loving again? You know, they just get frozen.
Pepper, you talked about the fact that, you know, that longer life expectancies because of medicine has really changed the game, so to speak. Has the expectations for dating and marriage among older adults changed as a result of this?
They do, but I don't think they're the same for men and women. I think you could have a situation like your very funny clip where the man is intimidated because a kiss means a lot to him. Or you have a situation where the man is sort of looking at the new landscape and saying, well, 3 dates and I'm in. And a woman is thinking, no, I want to make sure I'm respected. No, I'm a little scared about what these intentions might be. So the landscape is not entirely ungendered.
Pepper Schwartz joins us. She is a sociologist and sexologist teaching at the University of Washington in Seattle. She's also the author of numerous books and magazines and website columns and serves as the love and relationship expert and ambassador for AARP. And we're talking about dating for older adults right here on Central Time. Now, I could see people worrying, especially older adults, worrying that there will be no one out there, you know, no one near them, no one interested in them. Is there a big pool of people out there?
There's a huge, huge pool of people out there. And I think people overestimate the pickiness of other people. I think what happens is people get older, they get a bit wiser about what makes a good companion? Who do they want? The things of integrity and individual competency at life and, honestly, economic stability and good character. Those are the things that tend to matter these days as opposed to just flipping through pictures and saying, that one's attractive. I think there are a lot of people out there who don't realize that there are a lot of people out there for them. I really feel that if someone really wants to find a companion, and for that matter, a lover or a spouse or a lifetime partner, that they can do it, but they have to take it seriously. I often tell people, you know, would you just wait at your door waiting for someone to knock and offer you a job? And so I say, of course not. You have to go out and look for a job. Well, guess what? You have to put the work in here, too.
Now, we use the term older adults in this conversation, but that can include anyone in their 50s all the way to their 90s, really. There are a lot of differences between entering the dating pool in your 50s versus your 60s, 70s, or 80s. Certainly a lot of people on the older end of the spectrum thinking why bother or feel silly for even considering it. So what would you say to someone on that older end listening to this conversation and thinking to themselves, is it too late to try?
Well, let me give you a story that's real in response to that. I have a friend who was married for, 50 years. She decided after she was through with grieving for her husband who had been passed away 3 years ago, that she was going to find a partner. She went online. She did a number of things. She went to cocktail parties and would say, hey, I'm looking for a partner. The latter worked more than the former, although she had lots of dates. And at the age 83, she found a man who she described as the love of her life, even though she'd loved her husband. She said, this is a direct quote, I've never been in love like this, and they're now in their 90s and still together. And that is a true story.
We're talking with Pepper Schwartz. She's a sex, love, and romance expert and teaches at the University of Washington. She's also the love and relationship expert and ambassador for AARP. We're talking about dating as an older adult, maybe online or maybe not. And you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Are you an older adult who has been giving dating some thought? What's holding you back? What do you have questions about? Have you found a relationship as an adult over 50? Tell us your story. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And you can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit right here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. We're continuing our conversation with Pepper Schwartz. She's a relationship, sex, and romance expert teaching at the University of Washington. She's also the love and relationship expert and ambassador for AARP. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're a single older adult of any age, whether it's in your 50s or even in your 80s or 90s, would you or have you ever considered getting back into dating? Has online dating been something that you've considered? What's holding you back? And if you've had luck in a relationship as an older adult, we would love to hear your story. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go right to the phones. Let's go to Bill in Sturgeon Bay. Good afternoon, Bill. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just kind of caught the end of the last 5 minutes of your broadcast. I really have very little access and or knowledge of the Internet, and I'm just wondering what if there's any suggestions. I mean, I don't have internet at home anymore due to the expense and my health issues. And I go to the library, and I don't know if that is, if you guys think that's a successful way to go about it. You know, I'd love to have a romantic interest in my life. I'm in my mid-60s and healthy and pretty darn nice. A pretty nice guy.
Bill, thank you so much for the call. For those of you who are checking, Bill is in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Pepper, what are your suggestions for Bill who doesn't have the internet but would like to meet someone?
Well, I think what he said, he has access to a library. And I think if he asks someone there, look, I don't really know how to get to the dating sites, or, that someone will think that there's a great thing to help him. I always look for someone younger than me, way younger. You know, 15-year-olds are whizzes at this stuff. But, you know, just say, hey, tell me how to do this. And then I think a lot of the dating sites actually will give you a tutorial for free. You know, here's how you post a picture. Here's why you may or may not want to put a picture on. Here's how you write a profile of yourself. And there are actually people, you know, who do that for hire. But given that he's watching his budget, I think if you go to one of the big sites, Match.com is one of the biggest, but there's many others. And you can just go, say, put in dating sites, and they'll all come out. They come out by religious, Jewish singles, Christian singles, Muslim singles. They come from interests, farmersonly.com. I mean, whatever it is that's your background, if you want to look more narrowly, it's easy to find. If you want to look more generally, then you go to the biggest site, Match.com, or others like it. And people there will at least get you started, and then the directions, I think, could be pretty straightforward.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Bill in Heartland. Good afternoon, Bill. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. Thank you. I'm 54, and I've been doing this for about a year and a half, and one of the troubling parts about all this is, you know, you want to get into a relationship and move forward, but you really pay for a lot of the past relationships that your potential partner has had, and it becomes a daunting task because I think there's a lot of seeking perfection that's just so unrealistic that it makes this a real troubling kind of process when you're at kind of this age group.
Bill, thank you so much for the call. Pepper, what is your response to Bill's statement?
Well, I think he may not be as good as he might want to be in terms of picking people who are not bringing along baggage. Now, hey, we've all lived life, so we're going to have some baggage. We've had some losses, disappointments, as well as triumphs. But you want to look for a person, you know, of a positive affect that is embracing life and is enjoying life, even if they've had some setbacks. And I think sometimes if you are finding consistently that you're not finding a person, you know, who can be in the present and not have inflated expectations, you should bring the proverbial wingman, a good friend of any gender who will sit with you and say, hey, why don't you try this person? Or look at this bio of this person a little better. You know, they seem like someone, you know, who's got an edge. Let's not go there. You know, you need somebody who is maybe got a better picker than you do.
Pepper Schwartz is a sociologist and sexologist teaching at the University of Washington. She's the author of numerous books, magazines, website columns, and serves as the love and relationship expert and ambassador for AARP. She's also the relationship expert on the show Married at First Sight. And we're talking about dating and relationships in your 50s and beyond. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Christy in Madison. Good afternoon, Christy. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. I would like to say that I think we should start our own dating system and call it the Velveteen Rabbit, because when I go find somebody to love, that's what I want, is somebody who's been loved so much, all their fur is rubbed off. Because looks don't matter so much to me. You know, everybody has bruises, and it doesn't really matter anymore. At a certain point in life, the age difference and all that stuff, you just want somebody who's compatible mentally, and do you want to have sex? Do you not want to have sex? Is this just a companion for you? You need to be upfront and straight about all those things. And I think it's a wonderful thing that people are getting out there and trying. We're all still alive, and I think love is one of the most vital things. And I guess that's all I wanted to say.
Christy, thank you so much for the call. We really appreciate it. Pepper, what about sexuality and attraction? I mean, despite the fact that we don't often talk about it, you know, older people are still allowed to feel attracted to other people, right?
Well, you know, I loved everything that person just said. And she said, we're still alive. And that means we do get attracted. And different things attract people. In this person's case, you know, it's this right kind of heart. It's someone who's been well-loved and wants to share that. For other people, maybe physical characteristics do matter. But it's a big world out there. And you can match up with the person who has the values and needs you do. One of those needs for a lot of people is sexuality, whether that is making sure you kiss and cuddle and touch, or whether you need intercourse and orgasms are important to you and sharing that part of intimacy is something that you never want to give up. There's a spectrum out there, and you can find the person who feels the way you do. I have to say, at one dinner party I was at with some much older couple, in their late 80s, somebody was really bold and asked if they still had sex. And the woman looked at her and said, of course. So it just depends on the people. And no one should write off older people as if they don't want sex. Most people still retain attraction and desire.
Pepper, Bill in Sturgeon Bay had mentioned in his call about health, and health is one factor that older adults likely have to think about and deal with more than younger daters, whether it's a medical diagnosis, you know, whether it's diabetes or just not having the energy and the body that they had in their younger years. It could feel like baggage or inadequacy. What do you say to people who think no one else will want to deal with their health problems?
I would say that if you were find a person who you find has the other characteristics you want, character, ability to love, looking for companion, etc. If you create a relationship with them, they're going to want to take your health into consideration, but they're not going to run most of the time. Sometimes it happens, most of the time, because you are now an individual rather than an abstract idea. I've heard women say, I don't want to be a nurse. I've heard men say similar things, sometimes because they've contended with a very long and sad physical history with an ex-partner, ex-spouse. But the fact is that once we become attached to people, it's not an abstract idea. It's a personal thing. That said, I don't think you have to say, hello, I have cancer, or hello, you know, I have diabetes. You really want them to see you as a human being. And then if it gets serious, then you can say, well, here's some of the things I contend with. Some people won't want to take them on, but many people will not mind because it's you. It's not an idea. It's you.
We have about a little bit over a minute left. Something that hasn't changed since the last time been in a dating game is having to deal with rejection. It's already scary and awkward enough. So how do we handle being rejected as older adults?
Well, I write about this in a book called Prime, which is about me dating between 55 and 60. And I call it my pineapple theory, which is basically, I don't like pineapple. Many people love pineapple. Well, the pineapple is a perfectly good fruit. Some people like it, some people don't. So why judge yourself by somebody who just didn't like pineapple or just didn't like the kind of person you are? There's plenty of people who love pineapple and they'll love you too.
Pepper, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate the time.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. I do have to correct, I'm not the AARP representative anymore. I was for over a decade. And of course, I still think they're great.
Thank you so much. Pepper Schwartz is a sociologist and sexologist teaching at the University of Washington in Seattle. She's the author of numerous books, magazines, and website columns. She's also the relationship expert on the show Married at First Sight. She joined us today to talk about dating, whether it's online or in person, or as a older adult. And you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Talk about your experience dating as an older adult. We would absolutely love to hear from you. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Sackler family has made billions on the opioid painkiller OxyContin made by their company, Purdue Pharmacy. And documents show they wanted to also cash in on the addiction market. They're now being sued by the state of Massachusetts for their role in the opioid drug crisis. An investigative reporter brings us up to speed. So millennials are reporting they feel paralyzed by everyday life demands, responsibilities that they often refer to as adulting. We'll look at where this burnout might be coming from and what could help turn it around. And we'll take a look at a recent proposal to make Election Day a federal holiday. We'll hear the arguments for and against it and ask, what would you think? Would it increase turnout? Would a federal holiday increase turnout for voters? Would one party benefit more than another party? We'll take a look at that, all coming up right here on Central Time. And you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and email us at ideas@wpr.org to tell us what you think about making Voting Day a national federal holiday.